Welcome to Inside Analog Photo. I'm your host, Scott Shepard. The Inside Analog Photo radio program is all about the traditional photographic process. We talk about all aspects of analog photography, including the hybrid workflow. You can find out more information over at www.insideanalogphoto.com. And of course, Inside Analog Photo is brought to you by Fujifilm, making life more colorful. These guys have the coolest instant photography materials known to mankind. They have, of course, the pack film in 3.25 by 4.25 and 4x5, color and black and white. They have the Instax systems in the wide format, the Instax 210 camera and film, and of course the Instax Mini, both in color film. Beautiful stuff. There's nothing cooler than instant photography. You get a print, because if you don't have a print, you don't have a real photograph. This is great fun stuff. This is great for art. This is great for business. This is cool stuff. You definitely want to check them out over at www.FujifilmUSA.com/professional, making life more colorful. Our friends over at DR5, DR5 Chrome Black and White Developing, that turns your black and white neg into, that's right, black and white chrome. Unbelievable stuff. www.DR5.com. Our official media partner, APUG, the Analog Photography User Group, for all things traditional photographic process on the web, www.apug.org, and our official philanthropic partner, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film, over at www.eastmanhouse.org. Today on Inside Analog Photo, we're going to be here with Mark Osterman. Mark is the process historian with the George Eastman House in Rochester, New York. You can find out more information about what Mark's up to and what we're talking about over at www.eastmanhouse.org. Mark, how you doing today, buddy?
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us here on Inside Analog Photo. Great to have you on the program today to talk about yourself, how you got involved with the George Eastman House. And really today, I think we want to touch base on a very unique opportunity at George Eastman House about your teaching, the historic processes, and there's some stuff going on with George Eastman House and yourself that is really unheard of in the industry, and I think it's a really cool opportunity. So thanks for joining us today, and I'm looking forward to chatting about how you got into the whole George Eastman House gig in photography and what you're teaching. So this is great, buddy.
Sure. It's an odd and interesting story. I was teaching at a private boarding school in Pennsylvania, Quaker boarding school, George School, and I was teaching my students processes that I had taught myself, and that included wet plate collodion, carbon printing, albumen printing, a whole bunch of wacky things that no high school student you would think would ever have the opportunity to learn. And my wife and I were just working on collodion photography in particular. That was the specialty. And somebody at George Eastman House had heard that we were doing this, and so they sent a representative down to see what these Ostermans were doing. This fellow came down, Notch Miyake, he was a volunteer for the museum, came down and we showed him how to make a collodion negative and an ambrotype, and then he drove back to Rochester. And within a few months, we were teaching workshops at George Eastman House, and that was 1995. I had started doing the collodion process around 1987. France and I met in 1990. So by 1995, we pretty much had a handle on the process. The head of conservation at Eastman House at that time was a man named Grant Romer, a well-known photo historian and a daguerreotypist. He made it possible for us to come up and teach a workshop. That first workshop in 1995, I'd say it was a weekend workshop. Actually, it was two. We did a Saturday and a Sunday workshop. I think we had 12 or 15 people each day to take an ambrotype workshop. And we got everybody to make an image and get it varnished and get out the door by the end of each day, which was one of the tasks of Hercules, I think. But it started us actually getting the word about collodion out there. At the time, I think we only knew of maybe 5 or 6 people in the world who, if you put a gun to their head, could make a clean collodion image. And it's not to say that collodion ever died. Since collodion was invented in 1851, there was never a time when the process actually died. There's always been someone doing it. They used it for graphic arts in England up until the 1970s. But when it came to actually using it for making pictures with a camera or making art with it, there's nobody really doing much of that. There were reenactors. That was it.
Why do you think that there's been this increase in collodion? And you guys have been doing workshops and there's stuff at Eastman House. People are all over the whole tintype deal. So is it that we have this generation, do you think, now of digital that want to learn historic processes and this is very unique to them? Do you think we had us older people that were used to shooting film and they didn't care about some old process? I mean, what do you think is the upswing now? Because I'm at WPPI and I have people coming up saying, hey, will you come look at my tintype work? And it's like, what? What are you doing? What? And these people are shooting wedding portraits on tintype.
Which is amazing to me because, frankly, it's not that flattering a process. But yes, there are all sorts of people using historic processes now. In fact, they lament about certain films and papers that are not available anymore. But actually, we still have films. We still have developing out papers. Actually, right now may be the most exciting time to do photography because you have so much available to you. You can do any of the processes from the history of photography, or whatever they call alternative processes now. You have all of those. You have film still. You have sheet film, roll film. You have chromogenic color, and you have digital. I mean, it's the best time to do photography because there's so much variety. And how it came? Well, it's interesting. I mean, in the late 1960s, early 1970s, there was the first push of people thinking about the history of photography and alternative to modern films at the time. But what you found in that era were people making gum prints, cyanotype, platinum, palladium, maybe a little bit of carbon, but nobody was doing the in-camera processes. None of the people were making primary images. The Daguerrean Society, which I think their first meeting was at George Eastman House, that fanned the daguerreotype flame a little bit. It's only really within the last 5 years that you've seen a lot of people doing daguerreotypes. The use of collodion, like I say, there have been people that have been doing collodion since the time it was invented, but France and I have to take some credit in actually fanning that into a much bigger fire. Up until the time we came on the scene, there were a few people doing it, but nobody talked about it, nobody wrote about it, nobody published anything about it, and nobody was making any work that was worth looking at. In 95, we published our collodion journal, the first issues. We did that for 25 issues. And within a couple of years, the people we were teaching were now teaching. And some of the other people that were doing collodion prior to us, like John Coffer, he also started teaching. Now, we have great-great-grand students who are teaching. Somebody that we taught, Quinn Jacobson, went to Europe, and I think for the last 5 years has been over there teaching workshops all over Europe. So there are now people doing collodion in Russia. They're making tintypes in Russia. Tintype, ambrotype, same process. A little less so, the negative making. And France and I see that as kind of the next stage in people doing collodion photography is making the negatives that you can then use for a host of alternative printing processes. The collodion negative was the matrix for almost every printing process of the 19th century. Carbon was invented at the time when the only negative was collodion. Albumin was used with it. Platinum, palladium, gum, all of those processes can be done with a collodion negative. And I guess we have to wait for the last sheet film and roll film to be manufactured for people to really embrace that.
Well, at the rate things are going, hopefully that won't be too soon.
No. I like the idea that there's so many processes right now.
Do you think that this tintype, collodion, ambrotype, this whole process, that is unique because people get a unique single image? It's almost like the new school Polaroid. I got a unique thing. There's only one of it. That's it. Yeah. There's never going to be a different one. Do you think that's part of the allure what's going on?
Yeah, absolutely. The same thing happens with the daguerreotype. The daguerreotype, the ambrotype, and the tintype are the three main direct positive processes of the 19th century. Daguerreotype requires a plate that's going to cost you about $50. Collodion, you have a sheet of glass or you have a sheet of metal. Tintypes, by the way, don't have any tin in them. They're iron plates. The original ones were iron. And so you can use an iron plate that's been coated with asphalt and baked, or you can use a piece of aluminum that's been painted. There's a baked-on finish that you can get, what they call trophy plates, the things that they engrave names and insert them into swimming trophies and that sort of thing. But the process has been hugely popular, and I think that there are two main reasons. One is the uniqueness. Yes, it's the same plate that was in the camera, that was in the room of the time of that shooting. When you look at 19th century ones, you realize that it's probably the only artifact that's left from the experience of when that picture was taken. The photographer's dead, the sitter's dead, the building may be torn down, the cameras are all gone, but this one plate is that unique item that was in the camera at the time. The process itself is tricky to do very well, but the modern aesthetic actually is not to do it very well. Most of the people who do ambrotypes and tintypes say that the thing they like the best about the collodion process is that it's uncertain and that they celebrate the serendipity of the process. France and I would generally pull them aside and say, well, if I gave my mother my old Leica and a roll of Tri-X and a stainless steel reel, and said, here, shoot some pictures, develop these perfectly, and make some prints, that her results would be uncertain. The process wasn't uncertain in the hands of the people that were very skilled who used it in the 19th century. But I think the attraction of these processes that are made by hand, whether it's coating a piece of platinum paper and showing the brush marks, or seeing the edges of a collodion plate, that's really us screaming now, saying, look at this, I made this with my hands. It's not an aesthetic that they liked in the 19th century, but it definitely is a knee-jerk reaction to digital imaging for some people. France and I, in our last talk, we were mentioning that we combine digital with the work of Talbot. As an artist, I like the full palette. It doesn't have to have a historic thread. But for the work I do at Eastman House, it has to.
So let's talk about things today at George Eastman House. There is opportunities that people can participate. Let's talk about how your job has shifted now at George Eastman House from what you were doing. I mean, traditionally, I think for the past decade, you've been teaching conservators and people from other museums on these processes. And really, like you said, I think that besides what they've learned at George Eastman House, to been able to get in through some educational opportunity as an academic, and of course, taking what you and France are doing personally with your workshops, you've taught most of these people in the whole world now on these processes. And as you see, the people that are teaching these other classes now have been taught by you. So let's look at what you were doing for the past decade at George Eastman House and what's going on today.
Yeah, it's funny because when we gave these workshops for a few years at Eastman House, and that actually spun off to a number of people that became very good at doing whatever process we taught there at the Eastman House. For instance, we finished a workshop in daguerreotype at Eastman House, and the teacher who was there teaching the process was Mike Robinson. Now, Mike Robinson has evolved to be probably the most technically skillful daguerreotypist in the world. He took his first daguerreotype workshop at Eastman House, and so it goes. When France and I came up to Eastman House, and I think it was in 97 or 98, we came up as guest scholars and spent a year up here teaching for the conservation program and then doing some of our own work. As I was leaving, Grant Romer asked if I would be interested in a full-time position at Eastman House for a new program they were thinking of. I said yes. I went back down to George School, spent a year down there, and in, I guess, 2000, I was hired to be the process historian for the advanced residency program in photograph conservation. This was a very high-level photograph conservation program. It was originally designed as 3 2-year cycles, usually 8 fellows in each cycle, and it was so successful that they extended it for 10 years. It was funded by the Mellon Foundation. My primary job for that program was to do primary research, to go into the archives, to read the original texts, to recreate processes, and then compare my processes under a microscope with the ones in the collection. And if you can't learn that way, I mean, you're untrainable. I had the best of everything. I could look at the equipment. I could read the books. I saw great things for the 10 years that I was doing the program. But my main function at the museum was to write chapters in specific journals and books about these early processes and to teach the technical evolution and techno-aesthetic evolution to the conservators. Much of it had to do with trying to get them to understand that there is a way to tell the difference between, say, an albumen print that's well made in a poor state of preservation as opposed to a poorly made albumen print in a perfect state of preservation. And they look very much the same unless you know what to look for. And so I would teach a workshop once a month. Sometimes the workshop would have one process. Sometimes it was many as 3 different processes. And the fellows were learning really as a connoisseurship course for them to identify process artifacts and to understand how things deteriorate. On the other hand, my wife, France, was teaching artists all that time. Now, at the end of the day, for the most part, most of the people I taught, if they actually did the process, it was because of a project they were working on, but they didn't then continue on and become good at a process. Whereas everybody that my wife taught, most all of them were artists who then went on and did whatever process she taught them. France has a few processes she's particularly good at. In my job, I had to teach everything from pre-photographic techniques up to making gelatin emulsions and everything in between. Some wacky rare processes like albumen on glass negatives that I would bring home and say, look, France, this is interesting. Yet we would look at some of these things and say, well, they're interesting, but we can't seem to figure out how they fit in our art. Or we think they're too esoteric for her to teach to the public. The only times that France and I actually taught together through that 10-year period was when we would actually travel to another country where I was doing a workshop, usually through a museum. But that also gave the two of us an advantage that after the workshop, once we were over there with our equipment and chemicals, we could then spend another week and a half or so and do landscape negatives. And so we've been doing an ongoing body of work of that, which is separate than all of our other work. But my work at Eastman House was really just to teach photoconservators, very different than what France did.
So, Mark, let's talk about this transition and why this program ended. Is it because they didn't find it to be useful, because they lost funding? You would think that an organization like George Eastman House, it has, I think, the finest collection of photography in the world, bar none. And I've been there. I've seen stuff that would blow people's minds, right? You know what's in the collection. It's pretty wild.
Yeah, it's extensive.
You would think an organization like that would be able to fund or somehow continue what you've been doing. What happened there? I mean, what's up with these guys?
Actually, what it was is that, again, we originally had funding for 6 years. The Andrew Mellon Foundation actually extended it to 10, which is unheard of. And they were very pleased with it. It just ran its course. We knew that it was going to end after 10 years. Actually, we expected it to end at 6. It was a very expensive program. The fellows had all of their tuitions paid. They had money for travel, money for research. And we had a large staff who taught. And it just came to its end. There was no problem with it. And the conservation community benefited greatly because of it. I didn't mention that at least 7 out of the 8 people were from some other country. So every cycle we had people from all over the world. And it's really making an impact now. But the program ended, and Grant Romer retired from George Eastman House, and there was some shift in the personnel. And I'm one of the people that was still there, and I wanted to stay there. So in order for me to remain at George Eastman House, we had to think of a new program. We didn't have the funding to start a new educational program, but we suspect that that will happen in the next couple of years or so. We're just trying to rethink how we want to teach conservation there. So in the interim, they asked if I would come up with a series of public workshops, which is actually how we started at George Eastman House. So I spent 6 months. I was given a generous stipend by the Tannenbaums of Toronto to develop a program. And now I'm teaching a series of workshops on the kinds of processes I was teaching the conservators, many of which have never been taught the general public before. And that's actually what's exciting about what I'm doing right now. First of all, I'm teaching the public for the first time since before I came to Eastman House. And second of all, I'm teaching things that are unheard of in other venues. We spoke before about doing the thing at Laycock last year. It was the first time anybody had ever done photogenic drawings at Laycock Abbey. And we're having that same workshop again.
So really now I don't have to be a rooty-tooty educator dude from France that needs to come in and learn something. I can just be Joe Blow, and as long as I got some cash, I can learn this from the master.
You have to plop down the money, and you may think the money is a lot, but I don't think so. I've looked at the prices of workshops, and I also think that what we have at Eastman House is different than any other workshop. We do teach a few things that you can learn elsewhere and probably learn just as well. For instance, we have a carbon printing workshop coming up. Well, you can learn carbon printing elsewhere, but you can't learn the act of carbon printing and making the tissues, plus have a really interesting lecture on the history of carbon printing, and then go down into the archives and actually see vintage carbon prints made by Kayserbeer or some of the pictorialists. You just can't get that anywhere else. It's the whole experience. It's not just the process. On the other hand, we're teaching the Niepce processes. I mean, people have read about Niepce in the first photograph. Well, we'll be teaching asphalt heliographs and physiotypes. Well, the next workshop is the collodion emulsion printing out paper. Collodion emulsion printing out paper is not well known, and that's the hard part about selling some of these workshops, is that some of these processes are pretty esoteric. But if you go to an antique shop and you look at a basket of cabinet cards, and if I were to ask you to sort out the ones in good condition, you've got 20 seconds to sort through these 50 prints. The ones that you throw into the basket that are in perfect shape are collodion chloride printing out paper. It's the most archival, silver-based printing paper that was ever invented, and yet most people don't know what it is. For the listeners who remember the Centennial printing out paper that was made by the Chicago Albumen Works, this prints exactly the same way, but you coat it by hand. It coats beautifully. It prints beautifully, tones with gold, and you can make it yourself. I mean, it's a wacky process. It's not a normal process that people have heard about, but it's one of the ones we've chosen to do. And we'll do albumen printing again. At Laycock, we're doing a wet and dry collodion process. Everybody now knows about wet collodion. There are now thousands of people out there doing it. And yet, nobody's ever done dry collodion plates. I don't know why. They had a dozen different dry collodion plates in the 1850s through the 1880s. And we decided, well, nobody's done it before. Let's teach a workshop in that. So sometimes we take a risk of teaching something wacky like collodion emulsion paper. It's actually very exciting.
So what type of processes are you teaching that people can really replicate and use in a commercial application? And I know that there's been an uprise with people doing tintypes and other collodion work for studio portraiture. Like we said, it's a one-off gig, so I think learning the historic process has a commercial viability to it, to photographers to learn this and say, I shoot digital or I shoot film. But also, I can offer you something that's one-off. It's a true piece of art. You're never going to duplicate it. How do people get into this?
I think what you're talking about is the in-camera processes. So this last workshop that we taught was on the daguerreotype, and we had a fellow there who was a writer, although he writes other things. His specialty was writing about motorcycles. And he fully intended to go back and make daguerreotypes of motorcycles to illustrate his writing, his publishing. For this year, the daguerreotype workshop, the wet and dry collodion workshop, and maybe even the dawn of photography workshop would be ones that are primary image processes. The other ones are really printing processes. You're never going to use the Niepce process to take pictures of living people. The exposure times are too long, but you might use it as a printing process. You may even make a digital negative to then use with albumen paper or carbon print. And of course, that's being done right now. The digital negative is the savior of a lot of alternative printing processes.
So let's do an outline on what is available, what you guys are teaching, and how this works. So let's pick a workshop coming up here and give me a rundown of what you're going to teach and what people could actually learn by going to these and doing this hands-on process, because this is really a hands-on gig.
There are collodion emulsions that were used to make negatives, but the collodion emulsion that we're teaching in this workshop is printing out paper. It's used the same way as Centennial printing out paper or proof paper. In the workshop, people will learn how to mix the emulsion, which is not very hard to do. They'll learn how to pour it onto the paper, pour it off, let the solvents evaporate. We'll use some negatives that we have at the lab, and I'll teach them how to print, tone, and process the paper. I'm also going to include how to make Byrita paper. And this is a hot topic right now. A lot of people are looking for Byrita paper to purchase, but nobody's really been talking about the act of making Byrita paper. So when you're using the collodion emulsion, it works much better on a paper that has some kind of a barrier. And Byrita essentially is a clay that's mixed with gelatin with the hardener and a plasticizer. And this is spread onto paper. And it fills up the pores of the paper so that you have a nice smooth surface. But with collodion emulsions, it also helps to keep the emulsion on the paper. Otherwise, you can make a beautiful image, but when you're washing your print, you can actually have the thing slide off like a big decal, which actually is not a bad thing if you like emulsion lifts. But you could actually use it and transfer the picture onto something else. I remember the first time I tried to use computer paper to do collodion emulsion, and I was in the final wash, and this beautiful print started to float off of the paper. So I grabbed the closest thing to stick it on, and that was a white coffee cup. So I just submerged the cup into the water and kind of massaged it onto the cup, and that's still in my office with pens and pencils in it.
Who knew?
Yeah, who'd have thought? Transfer process. Actually, you could even vitrify that. If you were interested in ceramic photography, if you tone the image with another metal, you could then fire that in a kiln, and you could actually have a permanent vitrified photograph. It's one of the ways they did vitrified photographs in the old days. The sort of thing you would find on a tombstone.
Yeah, that is very cool.
Actually, that wouldn't be a bad workshop, too, vitrified photographs. There's so many different ones we could do. The hardest part is getting people to talk about the process and to come to Rochester. We've been lucky. We've been able to fill most of the workshops, but sometimes it's hard to beat the drum, and we really rely on the people who have taken the various workshops to talk about their experience. I think that on our website, we actually have some nice comments by people who have taken previous workshops.
I think one thing, too, is really with the work that George Eastman House is doing, no matter what their problems are here, there, or whatever, everybody should join Eastman House. I think if you don't live in Rochester, it's like $35 a year or something. And really, it helps support photography in general. I mean, this is the history of photography. Everything that ever has been done is in Rochester.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And thank you for mentioning that. I mean, joining the Eastman House is really, really important. I mean, you're not doing it for the magazine, although there's a nice magazine that comes with membership. And of course, if you can make it to Rochester, you get into the museum free, and there are other benefits. But the biggest benefit is that you're supporting a private institution that it's mecca for photographers. I mean, any important photographer worth their salt has come to Rochester to spend some time at George Eastman House. And not just for still photography, for film as well. If you're interested in the apparatus, I don't know how many thousand cameras we have, two flights down underground. These iconic images that all of you remember, you can see the real thing. You see these things in books, but to see the real thing up close, it's a real treat. So, of course, we appreciate when people patronize the museum and also make other gifts. Like all institutions, we need a helping hand right now and appreciate anything we can get.
Also, you have some, I think, very unique workshops coming up that I think that are really cool is you have the wet and dry plate collodion on glass. You guys made cameras when you did this work with the photographic etchings and the drawings. I mean, you made lenses out of magnifying glasses.
Yeah, it's funny, and it really kind of came out of the tracing the light imagery before photography workshop. That was one of those odd workshops. It didn't involve any photography. The workshop included making a camera obscura for drawing or viewing. People used camera lucidas. They used the tent camera obscura for drawing. We used a Fisiano trace machine for doing silhouettes. It was all about using light and optics to draw. So it really was geared towards someone who was really interested in the early history of photography or someone who can draw. We found that it was really for the people who did sketching and painting. But out of that, we realized cameras are a lot of fun to make. And pinhole camera work is interesting, and it's most interesting because of the image you make with the pinhole camera. But the experience of actually using a pinhole camera leaves you wanting. You can't see an image on a ground glass with a pinhole camera very easily. If you're in a room-size camera obscura that has a hole, not a pinhole, but a hole, that's a wonderful experience to have your eyes get used to the dark and to see the inverted color image on the opposite side of a wall. But to actually make a camera with a lens that has a ground glass that you can actually see a visible image is a real trip, and everybody should do it. It's not hard to do. We decided that we should just have a workshop where we make cameras. And we're not going to do woodworking. You're not going to see table saws and things. We're going to make cameras the way they did in the 18th century. They made them out of very dense cardboard. You make these beautiful objects, and then you cover them with marbleized paper and decorative papers. It's the hand skills and the aesthetics that we've lost over the years. I don't know if when you were a kid, if you ever made any of those airplanes that were made out of thin strips of balsa wood that were then covered with paper, and the paper was shrunk with dope. It's that kind of activity, it's that kind of touch where you can make something out of nothing, and when you show it to people, they're just astounded. And we thought, wouldn't it be fun just to do a workshop like that? So over the last year, I've been collecting all kinds of lenses. Actually just bought a tool at the antique shop this last weekend that's kind of a hand drill that allows you to cut various openings in cardboard. It has a little sharpening stone and a knife and an adjustable cutter. So that we can make these things based on lenses, which will then teach people how to understand how a lens works. What's the focal length? What do you have to do to make a lens stay inside of a tube? How do you work out where the focusing glass sits? Or if you install a mirror, where does that go? And you can take that, and if you want to go back to your own wood shop and make them out of wood, you can do that. But they're just as beautiful made out of cardboard with these glued papers, which actually make them feel harder. They almost feel like they're made out of wood. And then we'll look at the cameras in the collection, and we'll look at great cameras in the collection. We have probably the first camera ever sold in America with the bill of sale. We have Daguerre's camera. We have the Giroux camera that was Daguerre's. We'll haul out the good stuff, and it's really inspirational when you see these very simple apparatus and then realize that you can make them. And a little camera that we might make, you could put a daguerreotype in the back of it, or you could just as easily put a digital receiver in the back. The important thing is that cameras are just boxes, and I think that a workshop like the camera workshop emphasizes that.
I think all these workshops have a really very cool appeal to photographers themselves. So, I mean, yes, it's great to go and tinker around and build the cardboard camera and have fun with this and that, but I think that photographers that are current working photographers can take these wet and dry plate collodion classes and the dawn of photography, and I'm sure you're going to be redoing your daguerreotype history and technique classes, and all these things you can learn from is going to make you as a photographer better.
Well, what's interesting is when people who have come to this as photographers, And not everybody does, because we get people interested in the history of photography, and we get curators. But we also get guys that are just out of college or in college. We have students that come to these things. They often liken it to like a pilot who's used to flying a 747 every day, going back and flying a Piper Cub. So now they have the joystick in their hands, and they can feel that when they pull back on the stick, they can really feel the air currents under the wings and over the wings and feel the guy wires and things like that. The idea of going back to these very, very basic concepts of photography are very applicable to what they're doing. They then go back to their modern camera, and they have a different way of thinking about the approach in their photography. And then some actually use these old processes as a new look in the work they're doing. Dawn of Photography, we made images that were just knockdown beautiful. They're very primitive looking. At first glance, they could appear like a pinhole photograph, but they aren't. They go in and out of focus, which pinhole generally doesn't. Usually everything is kind of the same focus in a pinhole picture. But people could see application, and it wouldn't surprise me that in the next 2 or 3 years, you'll see that the influence of people who took that workshop last year will show itself in commercial photography. I mean, it did with collodion, it has with daguerreotype. It just takes a little time, but there are lots of reasons to take workshops like this.
It's huge. I mean, look at the opportunity coming up to take the collodion workshop. I mean, you can learn how to make this chemical that you can make your own tintypes and other things that you can do. Okay, so here's a 5-day workshop at Lake Hawk Abbey. So you're still at a very unique place in photography. It's beautiful. And I think someone can take this workshop for a very small investment when they get home. They can do this photography. You can stand out above the crowd. If you're a commercial photographer, you can do tintypes. You can do these beautiful pieces of photography on glass. You can do this on a mirror too, correct?
Yeah, actually, if you do essentially an ambrotype on a front surface mirror, it looks just like a daguerreotype. So if you want to do daguerreotypes without the mercury, you can do a wet plate on front surface mirrors if you want that look. The wet and dry collodion workshop this year at Lake Hawk will actually teach tintype, ambrotype, and glass negative during that workshop.
Well, really, I mean, too, if I can't make a workshop with George Eastman House, I can still make a workshop with Scully and Osterman.
Or just me. My wife is my biggest competitor, so I don't want to take away her job. But one thing that we haven't talked about, and that is the fact that even though I teach a monthly workshop for George Eastman House, or sometimes we have guest teachers, like when we had Ron Mallory teach the emulsion workshop, and just recently Mike Robinson and I team taught the daguerreotype workshop, your listeners should understand that if they have a particular workshop that they'd like to do, whether it's something we've already taught or something that's so esoteric that maybe we don't see that we could fill a whole class, they can contact me directly at the museum and they can come for a private tutorial. And that tutorial can include all of the same elements, and that is learning how to do a process. I can guide them through the literature in the research library, and I can even take them down into the photograph archives and sit with them and help them choose images to look at from the collection. So that's also another option. We did, I think, 5 or 6 of those last year. One of them, 2 fellows came from Tokyo, and I taught them how to make collodion negatives for albumen printing. And we did that from the back of my car. We went on location and shot with a portable darkroom made out of a cardboard box, which is generally how France and I do when we travel.
Well, it's pretty cool.
And that's the thing. I mean, it doesn't have to be one person. And we travel. If people had a sense of what they'd like to learn, and they have a venue, we'll work out a way to come to you. We can go to a university or some other school. In the past, if a group of artists had a facility that they used in their own hometown, we would go and bring our things to them, depending on how hard it is to ship chemicals. Certain things we can drive to a location. But we're trying to help people get into these early processes. And we really want them to come back to Eastman House at some point and really see what we have. Because I think once you see what's at Eastman House, you'll get hooked. I mean, I got hooked. I've had the best of everything there, and I still feel like I know nothing. I find myself doing research in the rare book room, and I wore out the poor librarian. She used to get books for me. Now I have a key. And so I'll be on one shelf looking up the topic of choice, and I'll happen to notice that the shelf below has an entire section of a type of photography I've never heard of. And so it goes. There are times when I feel like I have a really good handle on the evolution of photography, and then I find some esoterica that nobody has really researched. Sometimes I open books that have to be slit by the librarian when they don't cut them right. The folds are still connected. And I'm the first person to read the book. It's an amazing resource.
Just to have the key to the place is crazy.
Yeah, I wore her out. I asked for so many things the first few years that I was there. She said, look, now that you know the collection, I actually need your help. So when visitors come and they're doing research, the various curators in the print collection, in the technology collection, and in the library will sometimes call on me to help them, because I'm really one of the few people at the museum that actually uses all of the archives. Not so much the film archives, because my specialty is still photography. But that's one area I haven't really tapped.
Well, there's so much to learn there. I mean, I remember being there and the archivist guy pulled out an 8x10 piece of Kodachrome that no one has really seen. I mean, they stopped making 8x10 Kodachrome in the 50s.
They're pretty amazing, aren't they?
Well, it's just on a light table. It's like, whoa, look at that. Yeah. I mean, it's worth traveling to Rochester. If you book your ticket early enough just to go to the museum and hang out, it's worth the dough. I mean, people don't understand this.
You mentioned Kodachrome, and here's something your listeners probably don't know. It's that the word Kodachrome we associate with a 35mm and larger transparency invented in the mid-30s. But the word was actually assigned to another product just before World War I, which was a two-color color process. You took two different negatives through filters. You made two glass plates, which were bleached and dyed kind of a bluish-green, and the other one was kind of a burnt orange color. And when you put these two glass plate positives together and look at them on a light table, they have the appearance of a full-color photograph. And the process never went to market because of World War I. All the dyes in that era came from Germany. And so the term Kodachrome and that particular two-color process was shelved. And then they reused the term back in the 30s. And we have, I don't know, 100 of those two-color Kodachromes. I mean, those, when we put them on a light table, you hear audible gasps. I mean, people cannot believe that you could get so much information from two colors. It's pretty amazing stuff.
And you'll teach that if somebody wants to know.
I've been thinking about it. It wouldn't be hard to do. We just need to make the color separations. You make two positive transparencies. One has to be backwards if you're doing it on glass plates so that you can make them fit in intimate contact. And you just have to bleach them and dye them the right colors. And I don't see it as a hard process. And that's another point, is that if somebody wants to come and do research on a process I don't know, I will sit down with them and help them work it out. Because once you understand the evolution of photography and these family of processes, like the people who do gum printing, they know that there are a whole family of chromium processes that include carbon printing and dusting on processes. Once you have the sense of how a family of processes works, you can at least intellectualize and picture it in your head to the point to where when you actually start experimenting, you can anticipate what you're going to get. Or at least you know what you want to get and can travel that direction. So if somebody wants to come here and do some kind of research on something that nobody has revived, they can work with me and I'll steer them to the right books, and if they want to roll up their sleeves and make it work, we'll do that too.
That's what's so fabulous about what you guys are doing. So Mark, let's give everybody a call to action. First, they should go join George Eastman House. What's the website? Where do they go?
Well, they can go right to the George Eastman House website. All you have to do is Google George Eastman House and you'll find the website, and there'll be something on the homepage for joining. And there'll also be a listing for special events, which is what the workshops are listed under.
They need to go to the Eastman House website, click on programs and events and classes and workshops, and then they can find what you're doing. Directly, there's a link that says photography workshops. You click on it and it lists everything you're doing.
It has a whole list there.
But also, let's send them to your websites, because you also have lists of what's going on there at Eastman House on your site, plus more information.
Yeah, but it's crazy, because George Eastman House, yes, I work there, but sometimes France helps me, and sometimes I help France. So George Eastman House got two for the money when they hired me. And France, of course, she does all the work on our website, that's collodion.org. She will often feature what I'm teaching at George Eastman House or workshops that we're doing together on our own website. So it's in the family.
It's a great resource, and I look forward to our next chat to talk about some more of these unique processes, the workshops you're doing, and I think really it's an unheard of opportunity in photography. People can be all happy about their digital photography and all their software and all this cool stuff going on, but if you don't know where you came from, how can you know where you're going?
Yeah, and you know, the other thing is that it's not mutually exclusive. You don't need to think that a historic process has to have a link to the historic printing process or any other link. You can combine digital imagery with anything that was done in the 19th century. Whether you're using digital negatives to use with alternative or historic printing processes, or you're making the primary image using a historic process you can then digitalize that. I mean, there are no rules. And as I mentioned in the beginning of the program, it's the best time to be making photographic images because we have so much available to us today.
This is great stuff, Mark. I really appreciate you joining us again here on Inside Analog Photo. We look forward to having you, of course, back many more times to be talking about these different unique processes. But today, a great overview on the workshops and really what's going on with this whole program at George Eastman House and how people should really step up to the program, join Eastman House at minimal just to keep this program rolling and really look at the workshops and what you guys are doing because it is a very unique process that you're going to find nowhere else. This is not something you're going to find at a local college or university. This is pretty specialized stuff, but it's really about the craft and it's all about photography. This is great stuff, buddy.
All right. Well, thanks, Scott. I really appreciate it.
Well, there you go. The ever fabulous Mark Osterman, an unbelievable source of knowledge and just an all-around great guy. You can definitely check out what Mark's up to, of course, at the Eastman House website over at eastmanhouse.org. The Inside Analog Photo Radio program has been brought to you by Fujifilm for their full line of instant cameras and film and, of course, fine quality Fuji Crystal Archive paper over at www.fujifilmusa.com/professional. Our friends over at DR5 for black and white chrome at dr5.com. And, of course, our media partners of the Analog Photography User Group at apug.org and our official philanthropic partner, George Eastman House, over at eastmanhouse.org. I've been your host, Scott Shippard, here on Inside Analog Photo. We'll be back next week with more great analog photography.